Hi, I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop, and today I am excited to share part one of our first two-part story ever here on Heroes in Our Midst. Dr. Kurt Tribble is our guest, and when I first got this guy's CV or curriculum vitae, I had no idea how I was ever going to do justice to filling you in on all that he's studied, all that he's done, all the lives he's saved and changed forever, all that he's researched, and what he's doing now. And I probably still won't. But I do want you to know that the awards he has received and the positions he's held are far too many to mention. He's been on countless committees and a ridiculous amount of research councils and groups, always trying to find solutions, remedies, cures, a better way of doing things, and a way to help everyone he can live another day. His life's work is all about saving lives, and he continues to strive for that. And all the while, he knows that it won't always end the way he hopes. Now, Dr. Tribble and I chatted at the very start of 2021. And before going back to the beginning of his story, I asked him to tell us what his day-to-day is like and where he is right now.
Well, I'll answer the second part first. I'm in my office, which is in the University of Virginia Hospital, which is a large medical center like most tertiary care centers are. And basically, my trajectory here is that I came to work here 41 years ago and as a trainee, and then stayed here. As you have seen from glancing over some of my stuff, I was worried I might get bored as I got to the middle part of my career, and I might buy a car that was too fast or start hanging around with the wrong people. So I did a great circle migration around the southeast of the United States, worked in at the University of Florida for a while and at the University of Mississippi for a while, and sort of invoking that old adage that history only makes sense in retrospect, I now claim that I went there to study alternate systems of healthcare delivery because they were very different from UVA. I returned here about 7 years ago at the insistence of one of my proteges who had become the chief of our division. So returning would make my former student my boss. And what had happened in the interim is that our training systems had expanded, and they went from taking people that had already finished 5 years or more of general surgery training into the training program to adding a second paradigm, which is matching people straight out of medical school into cardiothoracic surgery. Truth be known, that older paradigm, which we still have, and we still have both of them, is unusual in the world at large. Almost everywhere else, people would sign up to go straight into their eventual specialty straight out of med school. But anyway, this new program has started, and for the first time ever, the faculty members here were trying to deal with a group of younger people. And when my friend called me to insist that I come back, he said, "Kurt, you're the only cardiac surgeon in the United States who's run a course for the surgery students while they're in med school, run a general surgery residency for the people who are fresh out of med school, and a cardiothoracic residency for the more senior people." And they said, "We just don't know how to talk to these kids, and you do. And we think you like it." And I said, "You know, that is true. I do like it." And this guy knew me well enough to know that he also had met my parents in the past. He said, "I remember your mother said you started being a teacher when you were 20 months old, and your first of your five younger brothers was born, and you've been at it ever since." But also, you know, as I was already well into my seventh decade on the planet when that conversation happened, he said, "You've been working these 100-hour weeks for decade after decade after decade." And he said, "We have a bunch of younger faculty members who want to do that, and we don't need you to do that anymore. And you were going to make that transition at some point. How about now?" I said, "That's fine with me." And so when I returned for the first time in my, you know, professional academic career, I wasn't taking call anymore, and not really, you know, operating, you know, 6-8 hours a day, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. And there were some lesser things that didn't require those kinds of long operations that I helped free up my other younger partners from needing to do. And I sometimes go with them, with the residents, particularly to get organs. Like we do a lot of heart transplants, a lot of lung transplants. So most people know you usually go somewhere else to get a donor organ and bring it back. So for me, a typical week is usually doesn't involve much time on the weekends anymore. And I'm not complaining about that. I roll in the door here about 6:30 or so each day, go home about 6:30 in the evening, something like that. A good bit of the day is taken up with some of the administrative things that are not that much fun, you know, making out schedules or making sure everybody's evaluations are done of the residents and things of that sort. But a lot of the day is taken up with, you know, lectures, maybe to a group of people. I just ran upstairs to talk to you from meeting with the just one person, the intern on our service, who's a really neat young woman, but she's not that young anymore. She went to the Air Force Academy and then paid back all of her military time before going to medical school. So she's a good bit older than her peers, very mature young woman. But the people at the on the lowest rung of the totem pole a lot of times don't get quite as much attention. And so one of my goals in things I write or in things I do is to try to fill in some of those spaces, those gaps to help them not just be workers, not just be working, but also learning and understanding what they need to know to be a good all around doctor. Eventually, in her case, she's going into anesthesiology, but for most of the folks that I'm working with, they're committed to a career in surgery of some sort.
Yeah. Well, it sounds to me like the education piece of this is so important to you. And I mean, we know there are surgeons who do surgeries. They just do their job. Now you may have answered this already, you know, with your mom saying you were teaching from when you were 20 months old, but did you know early on, I mean, no matter what you went into, that you'd want to be passing this on?
No, that's a great question. And the answer to that is no, not really. I was asked that a question of that sort by my advisor when I was in medical school, and he was trying to help me figure out where I might go to train. And this is a really neat person who's still a friend. He's alive still and a very good friend of mine and a wonderful advisor. But on that particular conversation, he said, "Well, do you want to be an academician?" And I said, "Well, I don't even know what that means." You know, I just was naive about, you know, the idea you could be training in a more community surgery oriented program or a more academically oriented program. He said, "Well," he said, "you know, like people are in academic centers, they teach." I said, "Oh," I said, "well, now that you asked me that question, I think I could do a better job teaching other people than the people who have taught me did." And then he did just what you did. He leaned back and said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Present company accepted." I said, "I have had some great teachers and you were one of them," which was true. Actually, you were a wonderful teacher, wonderful person, but beyond that, I really hadn't thought of it much. And so I said, "Well, I'm just going to go train in a program where once I've interviewed that I feel compatible with and comfortable in." And I was lucky enough to match here at UVA, and which was my first choice of places. I would have been happy with many others, I think, but I had decided for sure there was Virginia and there was everywhere else. I don't know. People sometimes ask me, "Well, how did you make that decision about where to go?" And I said, I don't know. I never studied Latin, but I know a few Latin terms. There's a Latin term called genius loci, which means the spirit of a place. And I said, I walked out the front door and I just felt that this place at that time had that feel to it. And it wasn't anything. In fact, I had a long list of things I didn't want in a program. I did not want to have to live in the hospital and every other night call. I didn't want to be in a program where they would winnow out the people in it. That's called a pyramid program. I didn't want to be in a program where I had to actually sometimes be in another town. all those things were true here. And I said, I actually don't care. I can make those things work, which turned out to be correct. But I know the kind of feel of a place that I want to be. And I thought I was correct in that sense from that one day of interviewing. I'd never been to this town before. Well, I rode a train through it once, but I didn't get out of the train. I only thought about that in retrospect. It's not there that there weren't other places that could be like that. And it's not as though there aren't places that could be like that now. And so I'm not making it sound like it's all that unusual or special or elite or any of that. It's just, I was looking for a feel. And that feel is created by people, not by buildings or, I mean, this is a nice town, but I wasn't going to choose the place I needed to train or wanted to train by what the town, I knew I wasn't going to spend that much time in the town.
That's right.
I thought it was, actually, when I left the interview, it was interview day, so there's some cab drivers out front, knowing people need to be hauled to the airport. And the cab driver asked me, he said, how'd you like it? And I said, I really liked it. And he said, so I bet you really want to come. And I said, well, I got to think about it some. He said, what is there to think about? And I said, man, this town is too small for me. I mean, there's only one town in America, literally, that is a smaller city that has this big of a medical center in it, and that's University of Iowa. I said, dude, I live in Nashville. That place rocks 24/7, 365 days a year, and 366 on leap year. And he said, listen, he said, you don't understand. This is a college town, and you can do anything you want in this town, legal or illegal, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I said, okay, that sounds like my kind of town.
Kurt, it's interesting to me when you say the feel, and I think right away you're leading us into exactly why we wanted you to join us today. I think many of us have a misconception of the field of medicine that wouldn't you pick a place that had the best, the first thing, the most important thing would be the academia and that kind of a feel. And yet you're telling me that it was the people, and that already makes us feel so much better about so many of the people that go into the field that you're in, and that is important. Is it becoming more important? That was a long time ago that you were making those decisions, but is it even becoming more important, the feel and the people that are actually in your field of work?
I don't know if it's more important. It may be, to answer your question, sensing kind of a timeline, it may be that it's talked about more or focused on more, or even perhaps thought about a little bit differently. I mean, we all expected for people to be treating us like we were in training for the Marines or the SEALs or Army Rangers or something, that they'd be in our grill all the time. And they were some of the folks of that generation that were the teachers and stuff here were a little more austere than people in my generation coming after them. To some degree, I think we just recognized it didn't have to be that way, but it wasn't that bad. And they, you know, maybe it sounds kind of weird to say that, but that those folks, in a sense, once they had literally adopted us, I mean, we were theirs, and we repaid their attention with respect. But to kind of dwell a little bit on part of your question, is, are things a little bit different in those sorts of realms now? And it is true that I think people pay appropriately more attention to dealing with people with respect, treating them with dignity and understanding. And, you know, and just as an example, I already said this once, but this may have been a little bit more straightforward given that I had been a resident and stayed here. I was the first person in about a generation who had trained here entirely and was asked to stay on the faculty. But they had sort of had a tradition of not doing that. That tradition went away. About half our faculty had some UVA connection ahead of time. But basically, I always had insisted with patients, with families, regardless of who people were, nurses, that I wanted to be called by my first name. And so if you walked in the front door of the hospital today and said, do you know this guy named Kurt? Or you went to the coffee bar, or you went to find the janitors that are getting ready to mop the floor. They said, oh, I know that guy. I have always felt that there's not much need for at least artificial hierarchy. I mean, there are times, particularly in dire situations, where, you know, there's got to be one person who's in charge, and then everyone else has to do what they say. And if there's an opportunity to make suggestions, fine. But we, of course, sometimes are in situations where that's not possible. Mm-hmm. I very much like the idea of less hierarchy and more creating more collaborative and supportive environments. And, you know, to some degree, it's not as though I'm a family doctor working in solo practice out in a countryside around here saying that. That might be just fine for them and their office practice, and that their secretaries and nurses and people and even their patients might seem natural, at least particularly over time. Looking back in the past, it wasn't so much that way. But it's my fervent belief since that our teams will do better if they know they can speak up and that their opinions will be respected and listened to if it's possible to do so. And I'm confident that our patients have had better outcomes because of that, that people want to and do work in a collaborative, congenial, respectful environment. And other than maybe at a time when somebody doesn't realize a patient's dying and you need to get their attention, there's really not much reason to raise your voice or to be too abrupt in doing so. Anyway, you were asking to some degree at the beginning of that paragraph about getting into teaching, and in the sense of history only makes sense in retrospect. One thing that was true is there were some awards you could get as a resident for teaching medical students. And one is an award they give to the one, there's 850 or 900 residents and fellows eligible for that one award. And there's 150 kids in the medical school class. And twice during my residency, the medical school class voted me as their best teacher. So the chairman of our department, who had come while I was a resident, was the one who came to me and said, I want you to stay on the faculty. And I said, why? And he said, well, first of all, we need another heart surgeon. But he said, number one, the younger people around here respect you as a teacher. And he said, I'd like to have our department have that, even more of that characteristic or personality. And then I said, well, okay. And then he turned around and said, and I want you to run the general surgery residency. I said, why do you want me to do that? And he said, well, when I got here, you were already a senior resident, so I'd ask you what we should do, and you would tell me, and then I thought we should do those things, and so now won't you just keep on doing them? And it turned out, I didn't know this till much later, that I was the youngest program director in surgery in the country at the time. So I did that for about 10 years. And then later I added on to that being in charge of what's called a clerkship. That is, all the medical students in their clinical year, third year, have to rotate on all the services. And when they're on surgery, that's called being on the surgery clerkship. So he asked me if I would do that as well. Anyway, I somehow got roped into that. And by that time, I was extremely busy clinically. I was running the heart transplant program. I was running the lung transplant program. I mean, I would have, you know, 30 or 40 people in my clinic every Wednesday on my clinic day. And the other days I was starting at 6:30 in the morning, going to 7 or 8 at night, and operating most weekends and that kind of thing. But I did always enjoy that. Well, I enjoyed my clinical work and I enjoyed my patients very much, but I also enjoyed my opportunity to be closer to the younger trainees. And I sometimes didn't like the administrative parts of those things, like averaging their grades or arguing with them about why they got an A minus instead of an A. But mostly I could get past that. Yeah. Frequently, I would just say, this is non-negotiable. You took a test, you made this grade. And here it is.
You know, you talk about things like heart transplants and lung transplants. And for those of us who aren't in your field of work, you know, I wonder about the performance in a field like that. I mean, when you talk about those things, those include life or death. You know, some of us who grew up in sport, you know, when we talk about performance, the outcomes aren't as stressful, maybe, or don't seem quite as important, although for all of us, our fields are important, but such high stress in your job. And then you were so busy tackling it in so many different ways. How did you cope? I would ask first. And second, maybe continue that conversation. And how do you pass how you coped with that to your students when you know what their future is going to bring?
Well, first of all, I think anyone who's in a stressful situation, whether it's artificial, you know, stress they put on themselves, or stress of they've got people rooting for them in an athletic competition, or people are performing live music, you know, like recitals for piano lessons and things like that. I don't think there's very much difference in how that feels. And as you know, at least somewhat, kind of recognizing that was one of the reasons I reached out to the sports psychology people here at UVA, who I didn't know at the time at all. I just had read about them in the newspaper. So I called him, the guy who ran the program at the time, Bob Rotella. And I said, Bob, I've been reading about what you all are doing, and I know you have a graduate program in sports psychology. And I said, I know that you're dealing with leadership and teamwork and how to deal with things when they don't go well and dealing with stress and performance under duress and this and that and the other. I said, that's what I do. I'm doing that too. And that's, I'm just in the same role, although I might be both coach and sports psychologist, there's sort of gray zones between perhaps. And he said, oh my God, he said, I had never thought about that. He said, we talk all the time about how the things we are teaching and learning about in our realm, sports psychology, are extrapolatable to other things like the military or business or music or sports, things like that. It's not just sports. And he said, would you be willing to come over to the ed school and give a talk? And I said, only if you'll come over here and give a talk. So we both did that. We had an exchange program, and we did that. And he said later, you know, would you be willing to have some of our students come and, you know, spend time with you in that environment? And, you know, some of the backstory of that, which is I eventually hired one of them, Doug Newberg, who had been an elite basketball player here at UVA when the last time they were as good as they are now. They won a national championship in the last national championship. And they were at least that good when he played here. Although he didn't win the national championship, they were ranked number one in the nation almost all of his 4 years here. But he got finished with his program, needed a job. I thought, I bet I could figure out a way to hire this guy to, you know, kind of help me with some of the administrative stuff, but also to learn from. And that turned out to be a very propitious alignment. And he was basically the only non-physician member of our faculty for about 15 years. Mm. And the great part of that for me personally wasn't just that he was average in the grades and getting the first call from the kid who didn't like the grade. You know, he could talk him off the ledge, and then he'd ask me if he really needed my help. And he filtered out about 90% of that stuff, which is great in my book. But the part I had unexpected benefit was, I still think to this day that he is probably the smartest person I've ever known in my life. Oh my goodness. Even now I get people, friends who call me all over the country and say, well, you know, I'm really struggling. I'm, you know, trying to, you know, I'm a young attending in wherever, Wisconsin, and I've had some bad results and I don't know what to do. And I said, why don't you talk to Doug? So he's willing to do that from time to time. And he does. And they always come back and said, that was amazing to and not just like one talk either. I mean, like over, spread out over time. And he has to listen to them for a while to figure out, but he can give more concrete, specific advice from having been around here for so long, that sort of thing. Getting back sort of to the core of your question, that we feel stress because it's life and death in a way that's different from somebody who feels stress when some game or some match is on the line. And when they too, a performer like that has put their all into it and probably for a long time and that kind of thing. I don't think the difference is much. One of the things way I like to talk about it a little bit is that this guy I was describing earlier, Bob Rotella, he had another grad student I got to know a little bit, a gal named Dana Lerner, and she helped Bob write a book. And one of the chapters in the book was entitled The Hardy, H-A-R-D-Y, The Hardy Personality. And basically sort of the theme of that chapter was that there's not much difference in how we feel, and probably not much difference in the biochemistry in our bloodstream at the time of excitement or arousal versus anxiety. And basically, sometimes at least, you can take a feeling you're maybe, I don't know if misidentifying is the right word, but you're sensing as anxiety and say, I'm going to take that to a different, slightly different place on the spectrum and channel that energy that's coming from that into arousal. Be more ready, more aware, more ready to do what you do, more aware of what you, what's going on in things as they happen. And I've always loved that idea of understanding the similarities between anxiety and arousal. Arousal is good. You don't want to be in any of those situations with an attitude or a sense, at least someone else might think you're this way, like just by from external appearances, but you want to be in a place where you're taking the energy of the situation, controlling it, channeling it into something that could potentially provide a good outcome. And it's easier said than done. I mean, I can think on my own, in my own training, I try to be kind of in some mindset like that, and I'd be doing something and, when my gruff attendings, say something almost beyond the pale, like, are you sleeping with this guy's wife or something? Like you try to kill him. Like, oh man, no, I'm not, I'd be first mad about it. And then I'd try to think to myself, you need to get off the ledge. He's sort of trying to, in his own, and perhaps in my mind, inept way, he's trying to help you feel what he's feeling, because he's more responsible for the patient than I was. Mm-hmm. I don't think I totally ever appreciated that till I traded sides of the table. I thought, I do understand a little bit better what, these folks who were trying to teach me felt. Anyway, I kept trying to think about it, the idea of how not many things are perfect, and often you are making a decision, maybe in real time and maybe very quickly, is this good enough, even if it's not perfect, with the idea that perfection may be the enemy of good. But also having to be in the mindset of, I do need to learn from it. I need to hear what they have to say. I want to get better at judging it for myself and, taking what they're saying to me and inculcating that. And I don't know what in the heck moved me to do this, but as a chief resident, supposedly one of the very busiest people in the entire medical center, I heard they're going to have a noon conference or a lecture by a person whose name I knew and I'd read her books, a physician from Switzerland, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, whose name you may know. Mm-hmm. And she wrote the book, Death and Dying, and talking about, bereavement and how do people manage, bad news and that sort of thing. So I thought, I want to go hear what she has to say. So I went and listened to her. And I'd heard her, I'd read her books before, like in med school, but I began to realize that this pattern she was described me as a trainee, hearing something I didn't want to hear. I got bad news, like the bad news she was talking about was that you got bad news about a cancer or congenital defect in your kid or whatever. And I'm thinking, I'm viewing myself as being trying to become a high performing person, maybe never elite, but trying to be better, get better. Mm-hmm. Right. And I realized that my initial reaction was exactly what she described, which was anger denial. Like, that stitch was fine. The attendee says, no, it wasn't. I said, yes, it was anger denial. Yeah. And then I would say, eventually I got to where I'd say, was it good enough? Sometimes it would be, sometimes it wouldn't be. So that's in Kubler-Ross's hierarchy. It's like bargaining and depression. You bargain and then you're sad that maybe it just isn't good enough. And then the last stages are acceptance and hope, which to me imply looking forward. It does to her. It did to her too, but she didn't word it that way. But to me, I said, I'm going to let that sweep through me in a rhythm that allows me to end up thinking I have learned something, and it may be 1,000 lessons in one operation, or 100 or 10 or 12 or whatever, but I'm going to let my sort of annoyance or sadness or whatever about the fact that I'm maybe not as good as I hope I can become, and let that energy then be turned into productive or positive energy to say, I am getting better. I have learned. I could not learn to do this without being here in this environment, as stressful as it may feel. So that kind of worked for me. And I also used that same sort of mentality for more formal reviews, not just the moment to moment thing of putting stitches in the heart, but like every week we have what we call a morbidity and mortality conference, or some people call it death and complications conference. But we review everything each week that had gone on in the services that was in any way, shape, or form a suboptimal outcome. Basically, the goal of that was so even more people could learn from something. And, you know, the protagonist, you know, usually a resident would say, this is what we did, this is what we think, this is what happened, this is what we learned. And then everybody can learn from it. Gradually, I began to realize really that some people would think that the people who are going to be best at least the kind of thing that I do and teach is that you're kind of this cold-blooded, not killer, but a cold-blooded healer, right? Mm-hmm. You just have this sang-froid, you're unperturbable. And I read a phrase that was written by a guy who was a sociology grad student at the University of Pennsylvania. And he wanted to study hierarchies. And he thought about, you know, a Native American tribe. He thought about the military. He thought about sports teams. And somehow he landed in a surgery residency out in San Francisco. He spent a year with them thinking that he would learn about hierarchies, and then he realized there's a whole lot more going on. And he said, I came away from there with one thing that was just front and center to me. And he said, in contrast to what I thought, what the successful people, both residents and faculty in that environment, had was a practical-minded obsession with the possibility and consequence of failure. He said, it's the exact opposite of what I thought. I thought they'd say, envision success, believe, you know, that kind of thing. You hear that sort of thing on all sorts of performance realms, perhaps. And he said, it's not that. And he said, it may sound weird to hear my observation. They're focused on failure, but they're not really focused on failure. They're not seeing failure. They're not envisioning failure. They developed a way of approaching it, mm-hmm. a way of approaching the possibility, and a way they know they can approach the inevitable occasional times when that was really the case. So it's a practical approach to that. And to me, it sort of gets back to the idea that at some point you're going to have emotions about it. Might be positive, might be negative, but if you're a sentient feeling being, you're going to have them. Whether you're the trainee, whether you're the doc, whatever. And you have to let those things happen because you're a human being. You have to get what kind of energy you can get from it and channel that into a positive direction. And one way you're going to do that is by knowing you're getting better. You're learning. And every single time you're in that spot or in that room or doing that stitch or that operation, you're on a trajectory towards increased ability and prowess and understanding of what you do. So I don't think, in summary, that for any performer that the right thing to do is to not have emotion. I don't think it's the right thing to do to have too much of it either, especially if it's not channeled, but to learn a way to take that energy and channel it into something that's good and productive. It can be channeled into focus, but it can also be channeled into helping you get over a rough patch. And, you know, some of those rough patches are things that really sort of are you or your team's fault. Some of them are, depending on your philosophical bent, you know, God's will. God probably didn't really mean for any of us to not do well with some individual thing. I don't get too far into that. I have surrounded by people who all the time, patients, families, people I work with that are, have some very structured systems of beliefs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm happy for each and every one of you all to have your own belief systems.
What's amazing is when you were talking about, you talked about preparation, not having emotion, but being prepared for that failure is just incredible. And how we learn from that failure. And I remember being trained in sport growing up in the 80s and playing high level sport in those days. And we were encouraged to not feel the emotion or the sadness, or if we did feel sadness or fear, we weren't strong enough. And yet when those inevitable emotions came, we weren't always prepared for those. And thus some just left the field. And I'm sure that is exactly, as an educator, you want to equip your students and in what they're doing to stay the course so that they can see the strength in their emotion, in their humanness. Now, when you grew up, I know your dad was in medicine, wasn't he?
Right.
So, surgeon. So let's go a little bit. I'd love to go back into so who is Dr. Kurt Tribble, and you know, why did your path lead to now where you are and how you are handing this over to your students? You're passing things on to your students, and obviously much of this was passed on to you. And in your childhood, what were your interests, and how did that path lead you to where you are today?
It's actually somewhat complicated and not very straightforward. I think I may try starting with a reflection that I had many decades after the time that I made the decision to go to medical school, because I you might have read or heard it said that I went to college. I'd barely even decided to go to college. And I finally went, I thought I was going to be a high school teacher and coach basketball and be an English teacher. I was an English major. It, you know, one thing led to another, and of my five younger brothers, two more of them went in, not just to med school, but into surgery. In fact, we've been told repeatedly, and nobody seems to know an exception, that we're the only family in the United States that had a father who was a surgeon and three kids who are surgeons. I said, well, for starters, in our generation, he stacked the deck by having six boys. Because at that time, most of the people going into surgery were men, and he wouldn't have needed that gender unified team nowadays, because, you know, half of our trainees are women and half the surgeons soon in the United States will be women, as it should be. Anyway, I was, especially once my other brothers went into surgery, I was asked that frequently. What did your parents do? What's your dad do? What did they say? Nothing. They never, ever talked about going to med school or going into medicine, or that maybe that'd be a nice thing to do or a cool thing to do or a good thing to do or a secure thing to do. Nothing. One time when our kids were young, we were driving from here, Charlottesville, to visit my parents in South Carolina. It's about a 5-hour drive. And my mother, you know, said, now I want y'all leave soon enough to get here for supper. And I said, yes, ma'am, we'll do it. And, you know, I don't know, one thing leads to another. And we've got two kids in the car, and one's got it, you know, they get two in one door, and one of them's already gotten out the other side and gone somewhere. And oh my Lord, you know, so we finally get everybody in the car, and so we're driving, and we're rolling on through the first where we live here. It's mountainous, so it's beautiful highway going through the hills and stuff. And we kind of come out in a more flatter area in Charlotte, North Carolina, and somehow it's getting a little bit later than we wanted it to be. And the boys saw some McDonald's or something. They got to have chicken nuggets. I thought, we are never going to get there. So, you know, they're hellions. And we just said, okay, we're just a drive through. Maybe it won't be that bad. And we get out of there and we're heading on down into South Carolina in the upstate, where it's pretty rural, rolling hills and summertime, sun's going down. So I call my mom. Everybody's asleep in the car by this time. And I call my mother. I said, Mom, I know I promised we'd be home for supper. And, you know, we're just not going to make it. and you guys can go to bed. My dad was still working at the time, even though he's in his 70s. He kept going to work till he was, I think he retired when he was 77 or something. So I said, yeah, and they got up early, you know. I said, y'all go to bed. We'll see y'all tomorrow. We know where the key is. We'll let ourselves in. And my mother said, Kurt, you know, in this family, we have never, ever eaten by the clock. And we will eat when you get here, period. And I thought, you know, she means it. So I said, okay. And so we hung up and everybody's still asleep and we're rolling along through the hills. And I thought, you know what? That's it. That's the answer to those people's questions, is that I and my brothers never once ever heard my parents, our parents, complain about what my father did for a living. He would come home promising to play football with his hellion kids. He was a college athlete himself. And he'd be there lying on the couch with his tie undone. He said, just let me lie down for a few minutes and then we're going to play football. Phone would ring. He'd pick it up, say, sure, I'll be right there. And my mother, that's admirable enough and a good example for us. But my mom would hear that and sweep down and say, I know he was, y'all talking about playing football, get in the van, we're going to get ice cream, just like that. Like, we're on to the next thing. We're not going to sit around and bellyache and complain and moan and everything else. I think for me, that's the answer to why we all did that. We weren't being taught anything negative about what he did. And in a sense, the lessons were not specific and not spoken and not explicitly stated, and there was no pleading and no cajoling, and people just did what they wanted to do. And of my three brothers, or my two brothers and me, none of us went to college thinking we were going to med school, and actually none of us went to med school thinking we were going to surgery, and then we all did that. And there you go. So I think, to me, in retrospect, it's a pretty valuable lesson, and I've never done it around my kids. I remember one time, one of my residents, I was taking to play baseball. They had this beautiful baseball field near where we lived that was actually featured in a Walt Disney movie, Mickey's Dream or something like that. We were going to go. We loved the place. And I said, guys, you know, Gene just called me and he said, there's a flying in this guy with aortic dissection with a helicopter. And I got to go ahead and go. And they said, okay. And so I go upstairs, changing some scrubs, you know, just to be ready to rock. And I come back down the stairs and the two older boys have changed into their scrubs. My mother-in-law had bought them scrubs. They had on their hats. And they said, Dad, what operation are you going to do? I said, well, we're doing it. Gene and I are doing an aortic dissection. He said, that's an operation on the aorta. I said, yeah. They said, we're going to do that same operation on this bear. But I guess I've you know, passed it down the right way. And none of them have gone into medicine. I'll have to say that, which is fine with me. They're their own people. Our youngest guys, the boys, are extraordinarily different from each other. They don't even look alike. I tell my wife, I said, what's the explanation? Is it a stork or is it something else? They don't look like me. She said, Kurt, they act like you. Be honest with you, I wouldn't have had any more or less pride or fondness for them or in them or whatever if they went into medicine or didn't. And mm-hmm. I think my parents felt that way. And anyway, you know, they did what they could to support it. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, some of that support was in arrangements where we were expected and did pay them back, but still wasn't the same as if we owed a bank and it was, you know, money lent to us at 12% interest or something, you know. I still marvel at the question you asked, like, how is it that happened? And it's just more important to be the person than it is to tell other people how to be. It's more important to model that than it is to tell someone else to do it. And yeah, telling people to do it doesn't work. Almost oppressive feel, like I've got to do this. Mm. And it's not what I want. I don't feel good about it. I don't get energy back from it. This is not what I want to do.
I'm amazed by your mom and her commitment to truly having decided to be in a relationship with someone who's a surgeon and know what that life is, and then not go back on that decision and then complain all the time. And I think we, so many of us in all our walks of life, I don't know what we expect from each other when we're in relationships, whatever that is, they come and present who they are to us and we say we accept them. And then we proceed to not really accept who they are and what they do, which in turn takes away from the great things they can do in the field that they've chosen. I think that's an incredible thing. And what an incredible strength that's given to your father and now to three of her sons, and how your parents did deal with that. And now look what you've been able to now also contribute and pass on, and you can contribute that and continue that in your students as well. And this seems like a never-ending flow of good, even though we all are acknowledging the challenges that come along the way.
Yeah, challenges for sure. And of course, it's not always all good, you know. Another saying we have is the worst of us can serve as good examples. Like, somebody does something that's not, you know, on the beaten path, and you think that's one way not to do it, you know?
Right. Do you have a story of a time where, you know, we're talking about, you know, back in the beginning, more in the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the preparation for things that aren't going to be perfect, the acknowledgement that it's not all going to go well, which is why we need sort of the tools that we talk about in performance psychology and those kind of tools. Do you remember a situation where maybe you even expected it to go well? Do you have an example of that and how you got through it? I mean, maybe you have, you know, more than one, but, you know, people put a lot of faith in you. They put their lives literally in your hands. And it doesn't always work out how maybe you'd like it to go.
It's a pretty complex topic. One part of it would be what kind of conversations you have with people ahead of time. So I had a partner for a while, and he would always say, when they would, patients and their families would ask questions, he would say, "It'll be fine." And that's a lie. Mm-hmm. We hope it'll be fine. Probably it'll be fine, but we don't know that it'll be fine. And so I never got in his grill about that. You know, he's my partner, right? And I don't even know if he'd given it much thought. He just kind of like, I know he didn't like talking to patients as much as I did. And so partly he just figured if he said that, that would sort of help end the conversation. And somewhere in there, there's an assumption they know getting a heart operation, that's pretty high risk, right? I mean, it's not like you're going to the dermatologist to get a little facial sanding or something, you know, and go somewhere else to get your eyebrows plucked or something. There's no doubt that that is the case. But to me, at every step of the way, every stage of those relationships, I would try not to overpromise what might happen and try to, in a parallel way, promise that we would care and that we would give it our all, that we would give it our best. And that beyond that, it wouldn't be humanly possible or appropriate and truthful to say anything more. Part of what you have to do about as far as dealing with the patients or the families with something didn't go the way you wanted is to do your best to convey that you care about them as a person. And I must admit that I believe that, I liked that, I knew that's the way I'd want to be treated. And yet, if you're sitting in a clinic, that my clinics were usually on Wednesdays, and I'd have 30 to 40 patients to see, well, you can't spend an hour with each one of them by definition, right? So I sometimes feel a little sheepish about coaching our students and residents up on how I try to figure out how to get past that. And I said, you know, one lurch for me was the patients sometimes would want to talk to me longer than I wanted to talk to them, just because I had time constraints and they didn't. But I began to realize that often they didn't know enough to want a granular answer. I mean, they wanted to talk to me just to get a feel for me. And I also began to realize that we could probably accomplish that in less time than an hour or even than a half an hour. I think to some degree, we as humans are at a survival of the fittest level, we're kind of hardwired or rigged up genetically to make decisions about who we trust. And that thought was very colorfully imprinted on me by one of my patients 20 or so years ago. And I was asked if I would see him and talk to him about an operation being recommended by his doctors. Looked like the right thing to me. I went by to see him, and we're going to do it the next day. I speak to him, tell him what's up, and didn't have too many questions. Pretty tough guy himself, it seemed like, gruff a little bit even. So later I got to know him better, and I learned that the last job he had before he retired from public service was he was in the CIA. He was an undercover spy in Europe and Russia. And before that, he was in a secret military unit that was doing all kinds of crazy things in the early days of Vietnam. And in this group, which was called this weird name, the Studies and Operation Group, SOG, the mortality in that group was 90%. 9 out of 10 of them didn't come home. And because of that, they had to re-enlist every 3 months. He re-enlisted every 3 months for 2 years and then came back. And one of his guys he'd worked with there was by that time ran the CIA and asked him if he would come be a spy, which sidebar was he told me later that by the time he'd heard my name, by the time I came by to see him, he had a stack of papers from the CIA headquarters up at Langley in D.C. that was that tall. He said, "Kurt, I knew every traffic ticket you ever had, every grade you ever made. I knew every girl you ever went out with. I knew the make and model and year of every car you ever drove." I said, "And you still let me operate on you?" He said, "I thought on balance it was an okay childhood or okay background." I said, "Jim, I got to ask you, how did you survive out there in the jungles in Southeast Asia when so many others weren't?" And he said, I knew how to pick the people to go on my missions with me. I said, "Okay, makes sense." And I said, "How did you pick them?" He said, "I talked to them." I said, "How long would you talk to him before you'd choose him?" He said, "About 3 minutes." And I said, "You could decide who you were going to trust your life with in 3 minutes?" He said, "I was right, wasn't I?" I said, "Yeah, I guess so." So it seems either right or lucky. But it was a reminder to me that people do make conclusions and decisions. And sometimes in those environments like that, you have to, probably in a lot of the 100,000 years we've been human beings on the planet, we had to. And on balance, those of us who survived and procreated were more often made the right decisions. But I think you ratchet it back to talking to, you know, a patient or patients and their family. What they're trying to figure out is whether or not they trust you. And that's what my friend was trying to do about the people he might pick to go with him. Do I trust this person with my life? And the patients are deciding the same thing. They're just like the SOG officer choosing who to go on a mission with them. And in this case, they're trying to decide if I'm going to be that person on them, maybe in charge of the mission, but for them, with them, whatever. Anyway, it used to be, I would find they were trying to do that just by talking like about anything. And sometimes they're asking all kind of questions. I'm thinking to myself, "You don't know anything about this. And like, how cold are you going to make my heart? Like, do you really care? Or do you even know? We're talking centigrade degrees. You don't even think in centigrade degrees. And like, you wouldn't even know enough to know that if my answer was right or wrong, if I told you something that wasn't even true, you wouldn't know." And so more and more it dawned on me, they just wanted to talk to me. And I thought, I get that. I would too. So why don't we talk about something interesting that might be useful? And so this evolved over a fairly long period of time. I've refined it over time. And I said, as soon as they start talking about something I know they don't really want to know about or want to talk about, and I don't want to talk about it either, is I would say, "What do you want to do when you're well again?" Hmm. Every one of them had an answer, and usually close to the tip of their tongue. Sometimes it's pretty mundane. You know, the older women would say, "I want to play with my grandchildren." The guys, the most common answer the guys around here said is, they either wanted to hunt and fish or they wanted to mow their lawn, which was always on a riding lawnmower. And I was always mystified by that. Eventually, because I don't like mowing the lawn. I mean, I like the way it looks when it's mowed. I don't mind doing it, but I'd rather go ride my bicycle or play basketball. And I don't have that much extra time. I'd pay some kid in the neighborhood babysitting wages to mow my lawn so I could go play basketball. Anyway, I think for them, part of it was they liked being outside. Part of it was they liked the way it looked, I guess, to some degree, an accomplishment they could see. And later dawned on me that it probably was the single thing, the only thing in their lives they had total control over was the height of that grass every Saturday morning. Obviously, by definition, no control of their health at that particular moment. Almost none of us have control over our spouses. Basically, probably couldn't control their kids or their grandchildren or their next door neighbors or their siblings. But they could mow that grass by God. So it was going to be that high every single Saturday. There were a lot more colorful answers of things that people did. And one guy was a marathon runner and said, I want to go to Greece and run the original marathon. And he did later. Anyway, it then dawned on me that I said, I don't know how I came up with this epiphany, but it really was cool. I said, I want you to bring me a picture of that, of you doing that when you come back to see me after your operation. And I knew when I was thinking that up that it would keep us in that mode, but it would also imply some things like, I'm expecting you to be able to do that. I'm not just hoping for good things, I'm expecting good things. Some years went by, maybe it was at a time when my wife and I sort of got sucked into being sort of avid yoga practitioners. And, you know, I wasn't much into things like just sitting around or transcendental meditation and Zen. And I had friends who did that stuff, but I couldn't sit still long enough. But I liked the idea of having something you could put in your mind and keep going back to it. You know, something distracts you, something's bugging you, something wells up, and you go back to that place. And I began to tell them, between now and the time of your operation, especially as I'd seen him as an elective case in the office and it's going to schedule for next week, your mind will keep going off to all sorts of things. All I want you to do is go back to that picture. I want you to think about it. Who's going to be in it? Where's it going to happen? What are you going to wear? What time of day will it be? What should the backdrop be? And just keep thinking and planning on that. And I never had anybody refuse to do it. They virtually all bought into the idea. And I would say 95% plus of them actually got me a picture sooner or later. Sometimes they'd email it. I even had one family sent me an update 25 years later as the patriarch of their clan, who had been my patient. I did an emergency operation on a Saturday on him when he was 75. He was turning 100. They said, would you be willing to send him a birthday card? He thinks everyone's forgotten him. I said, hell yeah, I'll send him a birthday card. And I said, but on one condition, you got to send me a picture of the birthday party, which they did. And unsolicited, they sent me a picture of him on his riding lawnmower, mowing this big old field over in the mountains of Virginia, and knowing there's no need to mow that field. He lived alone, and it was just immaculate. And I said, this is so funny. Anyway, years went by, and one day, one of my patients I told him that as time marched on, I had an iPhone, and I mentioned to somebody, I said, I keep some of those pictures on my iPhone. They said, why do you do that? And I said, well, to be perfectly candid, not every day here is a good day. Mm-hmm. And I look at those pictures on the bad days. I said, I'm almost certain your day won't be one of those days, but they do happen. And you know it, and I know it. But for me, this gets me through it. I look back at a double lung transplant on a kid with cystic fibrosis that was able to complete a marathon in the transplant Olympics or something like that. That's one person's photo I have on my phone, still alive, 25 years later. Wow. And I haven't had that conversation all that many times with patients, but I've never had it when they didn't say, I get it. Yeah. But it's part of the thing of pulling them into the system or this into the mindset of, we're all hoping for good things. We wouldn't do this if we thought it was futile, but we're not perfect. You're not going to be a perfect patient. And we don't know for sure what's going to happen. And the only thing I want you to know for sure is that I care and I will give it my all. But beyond that, that's the only guarantee I will never say it'll be fine, blithely. Don't talk to me about this anymore. I want you to know this is pretty high stakes stuff. You know, your heart's going to be stopped. And we hope we can get it to work again.
High stakes stuff is right. Dr. Kurt Tribble, facing heart transplants, lung transplants, and more, and admitting that not every day is a good day. But the question he asked his patients that really mattered before the surgeries, what do you want to do when you're well again? It inspired hope and built trust that the expectations were for a good outcome every time, no matter what the risk. And when the day was not so good, the answers that came back to him from all of the good days kept him going time and time again. What a story. What a lifetime of experiences lived by an incredible human, a hero in our midst for sure. And we are only halfway there. Now, after this point, Kurt and I moved to our rapid fire questions, and he had such insight into each one and so many more stories to tell. We've decided to wait to share them all till next week, when we will bring to you part two of this episode with Dr. Kurt Tribble. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, if you were inspired by what he said, know that there are many more inspiring stories just waiting to be heard at heroesinourmidst.ca or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. Share us with your friends and family. Subscribe to Heroes in Our Midst and be sure to come back. Thanks.